You are listening to the weekly Cybersecurity Podcast, episode number 18, summarizing security news and items of interest for the week ending the 30th of September. So let's get started. I'm Brendan from the ABSH Group in Melbourne, Australia.
And I'm Stuart from Velocity in Hong Kong with a brand new noise-canceling microphone that hopefully isn't so noisy.
And sounding crystal clear and a hell of a lot better than previously. If this is your first...
Go ahead.
If this is your first time listening, thanks for coming. Our aim is to produce this every week. Come back often and feel free to add this to your favorite podcast app.
I was just going to say you should have slapped me earlier, but anyway. So I guess our topic for the week is this week's record-breaking DDoS.
Absolutely. So we had...
Again.
Yeah, 2 weeks in a row. Look, we really should hope that this doesn't continue. But last week we had the world record sitting at 660 gigabits per second. And of course, this week it was smashed, coming in at a record 990 gigabits per second.
Yeah, the interesting thing is it's the same network of about 150,000 compromised Internet of Things cameras. In other words, people having cameras in their houses and offices, etc., that have been compromised and put into a nice little large botnet.
Absolutely. The interesting thing, and I'd love to see the stat on actually how many cameras there are to humans in the world.
Yeah, that would be interesting. There's probably 150,000 in London alone, right? I heard that's the most surveilled city in the world.
Yeah. Well, if you think about it, cameras in everything almost, you know, you've got baby monitors, you've got your door, what do you call them, your door doorbells.
Oh, phones.
Absolutely, yeah, phones. TVs have them in there now, so you can do Skype meetings on your TV.
Yeah, I heard recently that there's probably 2 billion phones now live out in the world, so there you go.
It's no wonder that it's producing the world record DDoS attacks. And that's a really sad thing, right? I mean, that's only 152,000 of those cameras. So imagine as the Internet of Things progresses and more of these devices get compromised, we're going to just continually see more and more world records. Well, the 990 gigabit per second DDoS, what did it take offline? What was it targeting?
That one was actually targeting a French ISP, and their CTO actually had a comment that he believes the network could actually deliver considerably more, maybe up to a 1.5 terabytes, but unfortunately 990 was more than enough to take them offline. So.
Wow, they shut down the whole ISP?
Correct.
They must have really upset someone.
Maybe they were. Yeah, you wonder who owned it, but maybe they were hosting a site or they had a comment that annoyed a particular person. Of course, it is the same network, as I think I said earlier, that took off last week's record-breaking attack as well, which took Krebs on Security offline, which is a website I commonly visit. A reporter that comments a lot on the dark web and on security incidents and so on. So no doubt one of his reports has managed to annoy someone in the underground, and hence he got himself knocked off. I don't recall if we'd actually mentioned this, but he had actually been hosted on Akamai. Akamai had been providing a free distributed denial of service shield. I guess they must do this as sort of a community service because he is a reporter. Unfortunately, Akamai was just with the 620 gigabits per second one was had to, came up to him one day and said, "Sorry, protecting you is now causing our paying clients." Some stress. We're not able to protect them properly, and so they discontinued the free service to him, and he had to go offline for a few days, and then came back online again. Google had taken up the challenge of trying to protect him from this botnet. So Google's now put him behind Project Shield, which is a Google project to designed to protect journalists and other, as what they call important freedom of expression voices.
You could almost put Brian from Krebs on into the investigative journalism category.
Yeah, I can't remember who he used to work for, but he was actually with one of the big media organizations for a number of years before he went out on his own. He some of the reports he comes up with shows that he obviously has some what I would call alternate credentials on the dark web. So obviously he's managed to develop a persona there over maybe many years. So he's actually getting into a lot of the underground websites and had commented in the past on Silk Road and various other things that have now disappeared.
Yeah, absolutely. He's sounds like Google have deeper pockets than Akamai.
Yeah, bigger network too.
What else have we seen this week?
Well, there was another interesting one, which was Cisco has warned of a critical flaw in some of their email security appliances. This is actually, I'm not sure if I could say once popular or whether it's still popular, but IronPort, I guess at one point in time, was sort of a leader in the email security space. So their appliances have been found to have a major flaw. Cisco released an advisory last week on a range of flaws, and apparently this particular one, we actually discussed Cisco releasing a bunch of advisories and fixes last week, and this was one of them that we didn't discuss in detail, but there's been some more details come out this week. The flaw was apparently due to some internal testing and debugging features that can unfortunately be exploited from both publicly by hackers. Okay, so the recommendation is pretty much as usual. Cisco has released a software update and instructions on a workaround if you can't obviously apply the update immediately. Of course, if you are running an IronPort, then I would suggest that you read the advisory and get the software updated. And moving on.
D-Link, our good friends there, have released a rather vulnerable router. Of course, we're referring to the D-Link DWR932B. And basically, the recommendation from security experts is to bin it. It includes a backdoor accounts and a default Wi-Fi protected setup pin. So I'm guessing they're hard-coded, Stuart? That's less than ideal, especially as it allows to automate the setup of your Wi-Fi network. And obviously this is research that was done recently, but the router I think is a couple of years old.
Yeah, I believe it's a couple of years old. It's been sold for a year or two.
Most likely been participating in a botnet for those 2 years, no doubt.
No doubt. You know, in this case, you know, you've just mentioned four of the flaws that the security researcher had found, but apparently there are 20 different vulnerabilities. So, very much a case of a very porous network edge device, and time to get a new one.
And right up there with recommendations that we have been echoing for many episodes, which is obviously A, you get what you pay for, but B, consumer devices, this is always a problem. You know, they're a short life cycle. They're released and then very quickly forgotten about. So unfortunately, unlike your higher end products, they just don't have that team of security professionals releasing patch after patch to plug those vulnerabilities.
Yeah, very much the case. It's a lot of these consumer devices, it's a race to the bottom. They're very cheap. They're produced quickly. They're trying to get the latest features out as soon as possible to beat everyone else. And in order to do that, security is the last thing that is often considered if it's thought about at all.
At all, yeah, without a doubt. So recommendations our end, obviously, if you do have a D-Link DWR932B, think about retiring it and purchasing something new.
I would suggest it. Don't think about it. Do it.
Yeah, you'll probably find you participated in the record DDoS attack of this week.
Next week.
Yeah. And a final vulnerability for the week, the vulnerability within the Bind system, which of course is very, very popular domain name server. There's a little bit relaxed on the details, the advisory, but it does suggest a denial of service is possible if you don't patch your Bind server. So those running typically Bind's found on Linux and Unix systems. So if you are running that platform and you're using the Bind service, certainly have a look at the patch and get that installed to prevent you from participating and or being a victim of a denial of service attack.
Yeah, just a quick comment on this. Bind, as you mentioned, is one of the most commonly used domain name server software. And of course, this, for the people that don't know, DNS is essentially the glue that holds the internet together, so that when you type in www.google.com, your computer or browser then goes and queries DNS, which is the domain name server, to find out what is the actual IP address of the server that that is hosting that. So if DNS is taken out, the internet does not work. So this is why this is actually a fairly and with Bind being the most popularly used, that's, that this is obviously a fairly key vulnerability.
Very much the best analogy I can come up with is pretend Bind is Vic Roads for us Victorians or your road traffic authority in other states of Australia. But basically, every motor vehicle has a registration number, and if the police want to send you a ticket, they ring up Vic Roads and say, hey, who does this vehicle number registration belong to? And the Vic Roads people say that belongs to Brendan, and he lives at this address.
The difference being that you want Bind to work, you may not want the police to find you.
Certainly, having an unregistered vehicle would be ideal in some incidents.
Yep. Moving on, we have our breach of the week.
Of course, and we're talking about, we should have like a, you know how you have a new song and it comes out and it hits the charts and how long it stays on the chart top 10 list for?
Yeah.
We should do the same for these breaches, because Yahoo hit our list last week and are still at the top of the list this week.
Yep, so they've managed to stay in the news, partly because of the scale of, obviously, the breach, but also partly because of some of the things that were claimed and they're now being challenged on. So, you know, one of the things that they had claimed was that it was a state-sponsored attack. There are a number of security researchers which challenged them on that claim and saying, well, how do you know it is, and so on. The other thing that, of course, has happened this week is that the U.S. Congress has demanded answers on that as well, about why it's taken so long to find out, and being fairly unhappy about it taking 2 years between when the attack has occurred and the disclosure, as it was put. Have called the 2 years between the attack and disclosure completely unacceptable. So, you know, it's they're certainly facing a little bit of flack at the moment.
Yeah, certainly doing some damage control, Yahoo. And I just have one comment about this. It's interesting, the commentary from security professionals has been that, you know, they said, oh, look, Yahoo claimed it was a state-sponsored attack, but they then came out and said, well, it is unusual for a state-sponsored threat actor to release the compromised data. You know, typically they wouldn't go to that level of effort to compromise the data only to then release it. So I think that was the catalyst. There's obviously been a number of other things that they've reported on that is unusual for a state-sponsored attack, but there's certainly some pretty fairly heavy evidence to suggest that, you know, it's not.
Yeah, I mean, typically if you're a state-sponsored actor, you want to, you know, keep it quiet because you want that to last, you know, the, you know, your access to accounts, et cetera, to last as long as possible. So you're not likely to then go and sell it on the dark web as there's a list of accounts. So I, you know, just from a common sense perspective, would be sort of leaning in the direction that these challenges to it being a state-sponsored attack are probably more likely.
Yeah, the only other option or the only other potential is maybe the state sponsor doesn't want to get blamed for it, so they when they start having a sniff around, they're like, okay, we'll just release the data now.
Or someone hacked the hacker.
Yeah, well, that's very possible. That's very possible. There's a lot of underground, whilst we've reported in a few times that, it's a very much a web of suppliers and distributors and resellers, there are certainly adversaries within that in that network that would certainly benefit from trying to make another hack group look bad or get blamed for something that wasn't them.
Definitely. Anyway, certainly the recommendation continues to be it's probably not wise to be using a Yahoo account at the moment. They seem to be in all sorts of strife, and hopefully they'll fix whatever issues have caused this, but they're very much the fact that it's taken them 2 years to determine it. I mean, there's certainly been some other major breaches where it's taken a while as well, but compared to, say, someone like Microsoft and Google, I think Yahoo seems to be falling behind on the security side.
Yeah, that certainly doesn't seem to have it at front of mind, do they?
Yes, I mean, of course, the other comment is that their former head of security actually left Yahoo and went to Google. Facebook.
Ah, sorry,
Facebook. Facebook, and that was over a clash about implementing end-to-end security and some other security initiatives, so... I think that there was a little bit of some internal conflict over how much security they should be doing. And of course, maybe that's coming back to haunt them.
Yes, 2 years later. And we have one more breach for this week, and it's actually close to home for me. We have the Federal Attorney General announced this week that we're going to change the current privacy law. They actually wanted to introduce a new privacy law that mandated it was illegal to basically attempt to penetration test, for want of a better word, Australian government institutions and attempt to decrypt any data held by government institutions, even if it's used for kind of white hack, penetration testing and so forth. And the day after the announcement, there was various security researchers who grabbed a sample of the data the government is attempting to secure, which is actually medical records from the medical Australian's Medibank, government-owned medical medical subsidy program, and it took them a day to basically reverse engineer and decrypt the data, and they certainly suggested they weren't using any type of quantum computing or high-end computing power to do it, and suggested, they didn't go into specifics, but they suggested that the technology or the implementation of the encryption that's been used is probably not up to standard, and the best way to improve that would be to allow your white hackers to actually test that data and try and reverse engineer it and then notify the government so that they can continually plug the holes and improve it.
Yeah, I mean, I have some very strong opinions around this. I certainly don't agree with the concept that we should make it illegal to do security research on things. That's very much like burying your head in the hand, saying there's a hole in the wall here, but you're not allowed to see it. What needs to happen here, because and why this is important is that if the government threatens to put someone in jail for having a look at this, that's not going to stop the bad guys.
Yeah.
If they cared about it, chances are they're probably not in Australia anyway, so good luck trying to arrest them and stick them in jail in Australia. So all you're doing then is making sure that the data is going to be compromised.
Yeah.
You're actually pretty much guaranteeing that it's going to happen. It's just that they've broken the law, we couldn't do anything about it, rather than actually saying, it's in our interest to make sure that if there are flaws in the way that we're going to implement something, that we allow our guys, our good guys, to have a look at it and suggest on how to improve it, and keep ahead of the game rather than being so far behind that you have to pretend that there's not a hole in it and you can't see it. Nothing here to see, move on.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there, which is, you know, the threat landscape is ever evolving, and it's not something that you can set and forget, right? So there should be consistent testing of your security protocols, your encryption algorithms, and all of that security processes. And certainly, you know, locking it away and kind of shielding it, I don't think is the right approach, but
Well, you know, one of the things often to bear in mind that if you do encryption properly, the mathematics works, okay? Encryption done and properly and implemented properly is unbreakable, at least the encryption that is best practices today. That doesn't necessarily mean that best practices today won't be broken in the future. You know, we've just gone through the process in the last few years for example, in web browsers, getting rid of some older protocols that were no longer secure anymore because the processing power now available, you know, since these were designed 20 years ago, has moved on and has made it feasible now to do an attack. But the reality is, you know, if researchers aren't even allowed to go and have a look at it, how the you're really basically limiting what can be done. And of course, the other thing, of course, is that while the mathematics works, it's often the implementation of encryption that is broken. You know, this is seen time and time again. It's not necessarily that encryption itself is broken, but the way that it's been done. You know, you use something like a badly done random number generator, and you can predict what the encryption keys can be, for example. Or, you know, there are things like that. Or, you know, sometimes there's a tendency for people to try and roll their own encryption because it sounds like a good idea. But the reality is, you know, you have a look at, for example, AES, 128 or 256, and those are, if again implemented correctly, completely unbreakable in today's ecosystem.
With today's computing power, that should be.
Yep.
Yeah, I think I think we've pretty much we've said our
Done
piece.
this to
Yeah, look,
death.
if anyone's those that are listening, obviously, you know, we've got some pretty strong opinions on it, and we've certainly communicated and done our bit to try and drive some awareness for it. And if you are concerned about it, you know, by all means, we'd certainly recommend reaching out to your local member for parliament, because it is a bill that's currently in parliament being debated. And certainly, I think security via obscurity, you know, by rolling your own kind of soup starter code and then burying your head in the sand, saying no, we're not going to test it. We're just, you know, we're blind faith that it works. And even if it does, you know, that's not to say that, like you said, technology evolves and it's not going to be cracked tomorrow or the day after. So the wrong approach. And the country also, you know, the government's talking about innovation, and you know, that's the next economy. I don't think that's spurring the government's mandate of innovation.
Indeed.
Anyway, moving on to reports for the week.
I guess we can start with the Trend Micro report on mobile app reputation
I
service.
loved this report. It was incredibly interesting. It was rather long, but highlights basically Trend did some analysis on their mobile app reputation service. So this is Trend Micro is an antivirus company, or a security company rather, and they provide security products also for mobile devices. And they did some analysis on there and found there was a 40% increase in malware detections from January through to August of 2016. And to put that into perspective, they're saying 16.6 million malware detections. That is just huge, and obviously is testament that, you know, the generation of the desktop and the laptop is shrinking, and it's shrinking quickly, and we are doing a lot more computing on the mobile platform, and therefore that platform being the majority is becoming more and more popular with hackers and those looking to compromise devices. Interesting, again, it was looking very much at the Android platform, and you know, sorry, Android and iOS, but they very much had some fairly concrete evidence that Android was particularly susceptible to majority of the malware. And I love the last part, which was they found a specific malware called Dress Code, which was very, very stealthy, had been in the wild since April, but wasn't detected until August, and was particularly malicious because it bypassed even enterprise security products. So the way it worked was you have an Android phone, you get infected with this particular malware, whether that's because you've downloaded a malicious app that's found on a third-party site or one of the 400 apps that have the malware injected in the Google Play Store. And these were things like games and skins and themes and phone optimization boosters and ringtones and all those kind of free type apps that we look for. But once it installed itself on the phone, it actually waited for you to go into a Wi-Fi network. It was then very, very clever. It used the Wi-Fi network on the phone to try and break into the network. And of course, because you're inside the network already, usually security is a lot more relaxed than trying to penetrate an organization from the outside in. And then certainly enterprises and larger organizations have, you know, detection for malware and rogue processes and data exfiltration, so data leaving their network. But this particular product actually used the phone's 4G connection to exfiltrate the data. So if it was able to infect and steal data from the local network that it was on, it then sent that back to the hackers over the 4G to completely bypass any type of security controls that were in the local network and also to avoid detection. So fascinating report. I think it's very, very clever malware.
I think it certainly shows the direction that some of these things are kind of, are going. I mean, obviously, there's a couple of things there. Well, one is, of course, is that even Google's Play Store, and Google's pretty good with security. They've managed to get over 400 apps into the Google Play Store, and I'm sure there's probably some additional ones now that they're working on. I'm sure, you know, this wasn't sort of the only play that they had there. The other part of this, of course, is leveraging things like 4G over internal Wi-Fi networks. I mean, one of the things that we certainly do with clients, wherever possible, we generally do not connect Wi-Fi to internal networks. There are some exceptions to this where there is an internal network for Wi-Fi, for laptops and things. But again, they're generally locked down to those devices. So mobile devices are connected to a, you know, completely demilitarized connection that goes directly out to the internet.
And that would certainly be our recommendation. But yeah, the other really interesting thing for this report was the it really challenges the whole bring your own device strategy.
Yeah.
You know, like, really, if you look at this and you were concerned about it, with exception of, obviously, you know, locking down your wireless, making sure it's not part of your corporate network, and that's often a lot harder than it sounds because you've got to balance security with usability, and if you make it too secure, then yes, it's going to meet the security objectives, but obviously users can't, you know, use their mobile device to, I don't know, connect to the projector or connect to the digital whiteboard or, you know, print to the printers, for example. So there does need to be that communication both ways. And so whilst you can absolutely minimize the risk, you can't eliminate it. And maybe we are going to head back to the old days of every user has a corporate device, it's locked down, it's got the company's corporate security products on there, and, you know, that's the only products that we allow into the corporate network. I don't know, but it's certainly a very interesting turn of events and something
I think it is a dilemma, but sometimes you got to look at this. I mean, now, I remember in the past where we had a client that, you know, they got all excited in some ways because, you know, their new multifunction printer scanner copier was actually going to allow mobile devices to print to it. But the reality is that the only thing that was actually going to be used for was printing personal photos. And the CEO of the company actually sent out a rule that basically said anyone caught printing personal photos on this is going to be fired, no questions asked.
Yeah.
So, you know, in their case, they would have been better off getting a printer that didn't have it in the first place. It was kind of one of those things. It was like, yeah, I can now print off my personal photos on this, except, you know, then the company gets charged for it. So sometimes, you know, while it sounds like a nice idea, I mean, the reality is how often do people really want to connect their mobile phone to the projector or to print to the printer or whatever else? I wonder sometimes what the real business productivity benefit of some of these things really is.
I can give you one that really comes up quite often for us, and it's the streaming music products. So, you know, things like your Sonos and your Bose systems, certainly in our AV rooms, you know, they want to be able to change the music, and they have music in various offices or, you know, various common rooms. And obviously the Sonos has got to be on the wireless network as well as your phones.
Well, can't they both be on the same wireless external network?
Of course they could, but then, you know, what else have you got on that network? So if you've got a television on that network, then that's running Linux or Android, and then that's vulnerable as well. So, you know, whilst you do, I guess, mitigate the risk of infection to the corporate network, you're still potentially able to infect all other mobile devices within that network or all other products on that network, and, you know, use them as a botnet or, I don't know, compromise them in some other way and try and breach the corporate network. But I agree. Yeah, you've definitely got to look at the return on investment like anything, right? I mean, and that's probably one of our recommendations. Don't just go randomly enabling features because they're brand new. And yeah, there's a number of things like UPnP is another classic example. Wi-Fi protected setup is another classic example. You know, these features, whilst, you know, they sound good, are major vulnerabilities.
And probably what brought down that French ISP as well.
Yeah, definitely participated in it. So summary recommendations, I know we've thrown out a few there, but just to be a little bit more structured, let's start with the very first part, don't get infected. So for users with mobile devices, Android or iOS, you know, they're both susceptible. Number one, stick to your absolutely 100% proper app stores. You know, whilst they're not 100% clean, they are a lot cleaner than your third-party stores. Number two, don't install apps that you don't recognize. You know, if you're looking for your Facebooks, your LinkedIns, your Googles, they're something we recognize. You know, when you go to have a look at the app has those brand companies as the developer. When you're looking at something else, maybe have a quick read through the reviews, Google the company, and like always, if you know you're looking for something specific, maybe ask your social media or your social network for some recommendations before you go ahead and install it. And you know, if something doesn't look legitimate or it's too good to be true, it usually isn't. And the old adage, if it's free, you're likely the product.
Yeah, and it's sometimes hard on these things too. I mean, you look at, for example, this particular case. You know, this was a bunch of bad guys, let's put it that way, and they had 400 apps on the Google Play Store. So if you did some research on their company, you would see they had 400 apps there. So, you know, how do you tell that they're not a legitimate company in this particular case? I don't know. You know, sometimes you look at the utility of things as well. You know, I've certainly been against things like, you know, the downloadable screen savers that have been available on PCs for a long time. And maybe the same thing should apply to phones.
Absolutely. It goes back to what you were saying just before with, you know, the shiny new feature. You don't need it just because it's there. And very much it's the same. You know, do you really need a custom screen saver or a... I don't know, do you really need a brand new ringtone or stuff? I mean, I guess it depends on the age bracket of people too, but I don't think anybody needs an optimization booster, that's for sure. Anyone using an optimization booster, these are apps that pretend to say that they're going to improve the performance of your phone or computer or laptop. Steer clear of them. I don't know of any, to be honest, that are actually legitimate applications that don't have some kind of malicious intent.
The snake oil.
Yeah. moving on.
Yes. This was an interesting report, a study by Sasha Romanowski from the RAND Corporation, basically summarizing, it's cheaper to get hacked than to build strong IT defenses.
Yeah, this was quite interesting, and to be honest, something we've probably spoken about a few times very briefly in the past. But, you know, they basically went out and analyzed, I think, 12,000 incidents across various organizations and, you know, found the typical breach cost is about $200,000 per incident, and the cost to actually implement the cybersecurity protection and defenses to mitigate that would be many, many times that. So, you know, it's actually a smart business decision to literally not invest in the security now. It's
hard to look at that with a straight face in some ways, but I mean, there is some reality to it. I mean, you look at, say, someone like JP Morgan, you know, after their breach a couple of years ago, they upped their security budget to $500 million. You wonder if that was good bang for the buck sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, and the stats were quite compelling. I mean, they did. It's a fairly large sample size, 12,000 incidents, and they were saying that of those 12,000, typically cyber incidents accounted for about 0.4% of the company's revenue. When you compared it to other threats like billing fraud or, you know, retail shrinkage like shoplifting and insider theft and stuff, billing fraud came out at 5% and retail shrinkage came out at 1.3%. So you are talking, it's the cost is when you put it into the big scheme of things, it is quite minimal. That said, I mean, we've seen the complete other side of this, right? I mean, we've seen organizations where a cyber incident has literally crippled the business and they've, yeah, they've gone bankrupt. So it's a hard one.
And of course you wonder where, you know, with something like, for example, Yahoo, you know, with their 500 million accounts that got breached last week and the continuing saga this week, you know, how much is this going to cost them? Is it going to cost them the sale of the business? It'll be interesting to find out, you know, whether in this particular case the breach and perhaps the lack of investment in security, as has been posited, is actually going to be, you know, they're already suffering. Is this going to be a breaking type event? And so yeah, there are two sides to this. Obviously, you know, on one side you've got to spend enough to protect yourself. I mean, you know, you can't go and say, well, I'm not going to spend anything on cybersecurity,
yeah,
because
course.
Guess what? You will regret that very soon. I pretty much guarantee it. I mean, you know, I don't know what the record is these days, but you go and stick an unpatched computer, you know, Windows 7 computer, for example, on the internet, direct to the internet, and it'll be owned within seconds. Mm. you know, there are, obviously there are levels here, and obviously there's too much and there's too little, and I guess the question is, what is the right amount?
Yeah, and just lastly before we move on, you know, the article did point out that this doesn't account for reputational damage, and yeah, basically they didn't account for it because they found it was pretty much impossible to quantify. So, you know, you've also got to think about that, and that's going to depend on your industry, right?
Actually, one thing I will add here, because they did say this in the report, and that they said it was similar to the Pinto formula from 1973, and this is a good case example. You know, the Boffins at Ford estimated that the cost of the company doing a recall, this was a car in the 1970s that had some problems. So they estimated the cost of the company of doing a recall on the model would be $137.5 million. But if the key recall wasn't held, the company would only have to pay an estimated approximately $50 million in damages expected for the 180 deaths from fire. So they decided not to perform the recall. Of course, what happened was that this was found out by an investigative journalist, a man called Mark Dowie, and caused a massive problem for Ford that was forced to recall and pay out damages. So they basically got double whacked. And of course it dogged their reputation for years. So this is a case, you know, where sometimes trying to do that cost benefit analysis and putting a cost on people's deaths in this case was a really bad idea.
Mm. Yeah. So we're certainly not advocating not doing anything. but to be transparent, and I guess we've got to represent both sides of the equation and both sides of the story. So there is certainly an argument to suggest that
you can't spend too much, perhaps.
Yeah, definitely. Like anything, I guess you need to have a balance.
Yeah. Now, do we have some time?
Yeah, I was going to say, do we have some time for a couple of news bites?
Just maybe quickly.
Yep. We definitely got to do the first one. I think that's.
Yeah. So this was the first one here is a company called Zerodium. I think we've spoken about before.
Yes.
So Zerodium offers bounties for people to turn in, if you like, to them. This is a commercial market. Provide to them security flaws that will basically allow for a remote jailbreak of both Apple and Android phones. And then this last week, they have just tripled the bounty that it offers for an Apple iOS 10 remote jailbreak from $500 million, which was their standard price, to $1.5 million. So if you are a good security researcher, there's a nice payday coming for you. This is a permanent bounty increase. They had actually briefly upped it to $1 million in the past, but that was for I presume a specific case that they had. Maybe they had a client that was urgently looking for one. It is believed that Zerodium was a possible source for the NSC in Israel, and we had actually talked about this in the past, in one of our previous episodes. It is probably an increase due to the increased security for both iOS and 10 and Android 7, is likely that obviously there's an increase in demand from certain governments for access into these phones. It has also increased its Android bounty to $200,000 for Android 7 and 6. But as you can see, there's a fairly significant difference between $1.5 million and $200,000. I cannot say whether that means that Android is less secure, but it certainly sounds like that from that one perspective.
That's a whopping difference, 7.5 times. speaks volumes for the efforts, right? I mean, it would seem that it's a lot more effort to break Apple iOS 10 than it is to break Android 7, but like you said, could also be a supply and demand thing. So I think we should probably wrap it up there.
Yep, there's a few more things, but for another day, if ever.
Yes, absolutely. It doesn't seem that we ever get to cover off things that we missed from the previous week, because every week is just a plethora of articles to talk about, and as we love this stuff, as you can tell, sometimes we just spend a little bit too long speaking about each incident. But wrapping up, that covers off the major cybersecurity related events for the week. Thanks for listening. If you have any topics you would like us to cover, please feel free to contact either Stuart or myself. Until next week, stay safe, and Stuart, like always,
don't reuse your passwords.